Hi, Blogging Heads viewers. This is Daniel Strauss of Woodruff Strauss, and today I have former office mate and White House reporter extraordinaire Justin Sink with us. And this week we're going to do some White House talking because everyone's talking about the White House and like past and present and future. Justin, you're writing for Bloomberg now, right?
I am. Where's Betsy? I feel like I'd much rather do this with Betsy. I don't understand what happened here. I feel like there's a bait and switch. Something went horribly wrong, and now I'm stuck.
Betsy's actually off in Wisconsin this week, reporting on possibly future President Scott Walker. But it's nice to know that you feel welcome and you appreciate my presence here just as much as you did when we sat next to each other at the Hill, working together back in the day. Thank you, Justin.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. So, first thing I wanted to talk about was Emailgate. Earlier in the week, the New York Times reported that Hillary Clinton at the State Department had a secret, or I guess she wasn't using the state.gov email address. And what's come out since then is that she had a router set up at her house.
A server set up at her house. And so she essentially had a computer that served, you know, as the go-between for all of her emails. And so everything went to an account that she had complete control over. She at no point had kind of a state.gov email address, and more recently has turned over emails that she says are pertinent to her time at the State Department to comply with the Records Act. Of course, this is controversial because she had total control over those emails. She could do whatever she wanted with them. And we have no idea if, in fact, the 55,000 pages of emails that the Clinton camp says were everything that sort of was relevant actually was the entire sort of enterprise.
I think I saw something at Bloomberg, actually, which said, like, the biggest or most important feature about her homebrew setup is that it allowed her to completely delete emails all the way. Like, Google still has old emails even if you delete them, which is terrifying. But the way Clinton set up, she could, like, completely 100% erase what was in there.
Right. When you use a service like Gmail or Yahoo, these are saved in company servers. They can go back. They can be subpoenaed. And there are both risks and rewards to that. So if you're conducting State Department business, you don't want to open it up to Google. It's the same reason that Bloomberg or I presume TPM or a bunch of other companies would say don't send sensitive documents to your own Gmail because it opens it up and Google could go look at it if they wanted to. It could be subpoenaed by the police. When you're a Secretary of State, that is sort of a security measure that could make sense. But the flip side of that is that the Secretary of State or whoever it is that's created this homebrew system has complete control over it. So if they want to make something disappear or if somebody wants to go in and look at it, they are sort of the arbiter and the person between there.
So, okay. So I know you haven't done too much reporting at Foggy Bottom at the State Department, but like you've been at that level for a little while and done that level of reporting. And the thing is, like, from my reporting on the campaign trail and on the Hill, it isn't unusual for you to sometimes correspond with someone and it switches over to Gmail or something. And, you know, I mean, like, sometimes that's really useful to reporters, I've found, because in the end you have, if you're paying attention, Flax or sources will use their personal email and you can keep that for later and get their attention faster or something. But it's pretty unusual for someone this high up, right, to correspond at all at that level or...
Yeah, I mean, I think that everybody has a personal email address, and I think certainly I've had experiences talking to sources using their Gmail accounts just because it's a way to flag for them attention or a way to kind of cut through the clutter of their inbox. And I also know, I mean, people have it for all the reasons you'd normally have an email. You don't want, you know, the stuff that you ordered on Amazon last night to show up in your work account. You don't want your personal correspondences with friends to be something that your employer could go in and look at. So I don't think anybody would object to Hillary Clinton having her own email address or having her own email address that she set up. But what was sort of unusual about it is she just didn't have a State Department email address. And I think this is, I don't know, politically interesting for a couple reasons, right? So the first is there's not a great explanation for why she did this, right?
Not yet, right.
if there was something that made sense, I think everybody would be more willing to give her the benefit of the doubt or say that there's a good explanation for this. What we've heard from the Clinton camp is that this is entirely above board, makes sense, something that past secretaries of state did. All of that would be a lot easier to swallow if somebody could explain why she didn't just use her state.gov email address, right? So that it's very difficult, I think, to explain that part of it away. It's especially difficult when you are the Clintons and you've got a history of working really hard to keep people from going through their documents. And, you know, this is something that happened with Whitewater. It happened with the travel office. It happened with her healthcare panel when she was first lady. And so I think that while some people might be afforded kind of a longer rope on an issue like this, issues of secrecy and privacy have dogged the Clintons for a very long time. And so it's something that in the same way that I think Chris Christie's sort of bridge scandal fed into a pre-existing image of him as kind of a bully, this feeds into a pre-existing a vision of the Clintons as excessively secretive.
I thought that was really well said. I mean, because for a long time, Clinton has done, I think like 2 weeks ago, or maybe it was even a week ago, the Washington Post had a story titled Hillary Clinton 5.0. And you definitely, I mean, like, it just struck me when she spoke, she was interviewed by Kara Swisher of Recode, and she seemed much more likable and much more relatable and much more personable. This is something the Clintons have really worked at. And this email thing, I mean, if it sticks, it seems to be sticking in D.C., but I'm really skeptical about how it'll stick nationally, is sort of a reversal of that or sort of pushes her back some. But, like, I got to be honest, man, I am a little bit of me is kind of skeptical about how – because it's hard to explain to a voter in, like, Iowa or Idaho or, like, Arizona, like – this is what Hillary Clinton did. It's really easy. That's the same thing with Scott Walker and the John Doe investigations, right? So the Christie bridge scandal thing is fairly easy to explain. There is reason to believe that Christie got pissed at someone for not endorsing him, so he closed a bridge to punish him, and that was a big deal. Can't really explain the John Doe investigations, and I don't really – I mean, I guess Hillary Clinton had a secret email address and hid her State Department goings on there, but it's I don't know.
I don't mean any of this to suggest that it's in any way sort of a deal breaker for what is probably the most likely candidacy of any candidacy, certainly of our lifetime, right? Like,
yeah.
It's going to take a lot to sort of derail the freight train that is Hillary Clinton in this Democratic primary. It's just to the extent that Hillary Clinton has a vulnerability, it is going to be convincing people that that she is departing from some of the legacies that people don't like about the Clinton administration. So they have a lot that they can talk about that I think appeals to moderate and independent voters that will be key to this election in terms of President Clinton's economic record, in terms of sort of the 90s being well remembered. But, you know, the Clinton White House is also defined by partisanship, by investigations, by scandal, by secrecy. And putting even all that aside, it's going to be very important for Hillary Clinton to be able to sort of present a forward-looking message for why she should be president. And relitigating those battles every day and every week that she has to do that is a week or a day that she's not able to sort of present that forward-looking message. And we are a long way out, and so this is not in any way sort of a deal-breaker, but this is something that...
Do you remember in 2008, I mean, the first scandal of the Democratic primary was Obama calling Hillary Clinton Bush Light or something like that?
I do remember that, like... Fairly vaguely, yeah.
At the time, for like a week, it was like the big thing or something, you know? And it was,
right.
It was huge part for multiple dimensions, one of which was like, you know, this guy who's this also running for president guy from Illinois is like talking shit about Hillary.
Right.
This might be that or maybe not. I don't know. But yeah, you're right that the importance of this is, I guess, I mean, politically, the importance of this is that, you know, it feeds into the negative notions of the Clintons that they've been working hard to kind of shed, and gives Republicans something to, you know, bash Hillary about instead of fight amongst themselves.
I do think that there's one other element that is sort of interesting and at play here, which is the way that Team Clinton is sort of able to respond to crises, because this is not the first, will not be the last sort of flare up in a campaign. A campaign, in fact, is day after day of these types of issues.
I thought it was really kind of clumsy so far.
It's certainly not been well received by Democrats here in Washington. Now, I think Team Clinton would say, wait and see if this thing has legs, see if it is something that is going to be an issue that voters care about a couple months, or even remember a couple months or a couple weeks from now. On top of that, I think they kind of argue, you know, we've disclosed everything we should. The secretary has called for all of her emails to be released. We are being transparent. They feel like they're going to be vindicated in terms of this. And so all of these issues are at play. They're playing the long game. So whether or not you give them the benefit of the doubt is up to you. But undoubtedly, this is a test of her communications infrastructure and is going to be one of many sort of challenges. And after 2008, I think there's a lot of, there's an intense focus on her campaign, on her sort of the people in her inner circle and how well they're able to navigate the political climate in 2015.
Yeah, I definitely see that. And like the knee jerk reaction has been so far, it's been above the book, you know, it's been by the books. Clinton did nothing wrong. And then look at these other email scandals, you know, pointing to Bush not being transparent, but saying he's been Jeb Bush being transparent and saying he's been transparent, and on emails, and also Scott Walker having his own email sort of flare up in one of the John Doe investigations, which I keep referencing, where basically this one was over staffers for Walker setting up a secret router and conducting political business on government hours, which is a felony. It's hard to sell. I gotta be honest though, man. I don't know if you're gonna say anything on this. I think that it hasn't been the Clinton people were caught with their pants down on this, and it's sort of a symptom of the non-campaign that they're in, right? There are these three big organizations that make up the proto-Hillary campaign, Correct the Record, Priorities USA, and I guess American Bridge, or let's get the third one. Ready for Hillary.
Right.
And Correct the Record has been sort of working on this. There have been Hillary surrogates who've come out and been like this, but it wasn't. It's like clear, I think, to me that there is no, they don't have like a singular war room set up and like, you know, staffers saying this is what we want to do and tell this person to go here yet.
Well, and I mean, and the manifestation that I've seen of that is that Josh Earnest, the press secretary for President Obama, has been the one who, for two straight days, has had to go out in front of the cameras and take really hard questions from it. And Josh Earnest is a guy who, you know, was a lot. There was this very sad moment, I think, on Tuesday where Josh kind of had to admit, even though he's a cabinet level secretary now, that he's never emailed with Hillary Clinton. Right. I mean, this is something that, you know, has really been deposited in the lap of the White House because there is no campaign infrastructure in place for Hillary Clinton to sort of combat it. And we're in this strange gray area where, you know, the president is still the leader of the Democratic Party and the face of the administration and of the party. And so the White House is going to be the one that kind of has to pick up the slack here. And I think somebody tweeted, and maybe it was Josh Letterman, who also used to sit in the corner with us, that hopefully Hillary is buying Josh Earnest a fruit basket or something after this week, because he's really come under some pretty tough fire for all this.
Yeah, so this is one of the things I was looking forward to with having you on. Can you tell? And I feel like I'm asking you out. I feel like one of those newscasters who are like, can you tell us what's happening out of an event? And they clearly are like, I have no updates, but they have to fill the time. Is there any like visible feeling among the Obama White House on this? Is there any frustration? And like, what is, I mean, like, it's just such a weird, like you said, it's such a weird place to be in for them.
I think to the extent that I can talk about what they've said privately about this, they're frustrated with the media that this has been a story that the White House has been forced to respond to so often. So I don't think any of them doubt that we have serious and legitimate questions about this. They get why it's a question and why it's going on. But there is a certain relentlessness to what have been the last couple White House briefings where, you know, Josh made pretty clear, I think, on day one, what he was going to say and what he wasn't going to say. And it's our job to keep pushing and prodding that in hopes that we will get something out of it. But it also, we're doing our job. I get they're doing their job. And I get also why they kind of feel like, okay, guys, we've been doing this for a long time. What more do you want us to say about it? And so,
yeah, I mean, it's kind of, they're kind of bystanders and kind of not here. It's kind of, it's just a funny place to be in.
but you know, at the same time, I mean, obviously this is a decision that Hillary Clinton made and that kind of ran out of the State Department, and they are the sort of central figures of this, but being president means that you are in charge of your cabinet and of your departments and of your secretaries and their behavior. And, you know, if, I don't know, Jack Lew had a secret email exchange where he was kind of talking with corporate CEOs and having discussions about work products completely off the books, I think we'd be asking similarly tough questions of the White House, and there would be a sort of responsibility to it. So undoubtedly, like, this is a big story because Hillary Clinton is Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
But I don't think that should entirely absolve the White House of their role as the leaders of the Obama administration, the government. And so I get why they're frustrated, but I also think that it's important to ask these questions.
Okay. You would be right to want to shoot me for the following question, and I kind of want to shoot myself here, but I can't resist asking sort of the Beltway This Town question, which is, could this turn into a new or resurrected sort of tension between Hillary's people and Obama's people? I know it's kind of, I know it's like, but it's kind of, I don't know, maybe it won't. Just say no if it won't.
I mean, I think if we've seen anything over the last couple of weeks, you know, the last day or two, notwithstanding, it's a real merging of Team Obama and Team Clinton.
Really?
So, I mean, just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen John Podesta, who's the senior advisor to President Obama, leave the White House fully intending to go kind of play the chairman role in Hillary's campaign. We saw Jen Palmieri, who's communications director. She's still upstairs, but she, in a couple weeks, is going to go and be the communications director for Hillary's campaign. Eric Schultz, the deputy press secretary, has not confirmed any of it, but it's largely assumed that once the primaries kind of wrap up, he'll be moving from the White House over to Hillary's campaign. And that's just on the communication side. So there is a lot of sort of evidence that Hillary is hiring Obama campaign staffers to run her ground game. She's hiring Obama pollsters. And she's really trying to, I think, learn from the mistakes that she made in 2008 and bring in the people who beat her in 2008. But as a byproduct of that, you've got people who are very close to President Obama and his team and his close advisors now working for or about to work for Hillary. And so I think that, you know, while that tension existed, I think we've moved to a point where the White House is a little more circumspect about the fact that 2016 is coming right up and this transition is happening, whether they want to maintain their relevance or not. And I think we've also reached a point where a lot of Obama people are sort of infiltrating Hillary world, and that makes it much harder for there to be sort of some of the, your camp, my camp divisions that we saw earlier in the Obama presidency.
Well, that's disappointing for journalists who need to write copy. But it's actually, that's really interesting. Let me ask you something related to this, because it did sort of remind me, how do you think, I mean, you were the lead Romney reporter at The Hill, which I think was your last campaign?
Yeah, after that I came over here to right. the Casablanca.
Right. It strikes me that, like, the landscape is so different for Democrats than it was in 2008. What do you think of the landscape among Republicans in 2012 compared to now? So far, Romney was really sort of, I mean, Romney wasn't at Hillary level of inevitable, but she was very clearly the front runner. And I feel like more and more, Jeb Bush is seen as the financial front runner. He's got a lot of money, but a lot of recent polling has shown Scott Walker to be competitive or even ahead. And I think one of the most telling things, indicators of this, was Scott Walker came in second in the CPAC straw poll. At first look, that, you know, and a lot of the coverage, and if I, you know, in TPMs included, our headline for this was Rand Paul wins CPoll straw poll again. But it's always Rand Paul winning. He's won for three straight years, and it's his event. Walker came really close in second. So, I mean, that's a big thing. And I think it's very clear that this is a competitive primary on the Republican side. Do you think that's a fair read? Is that similar to 2012?
I think one big takeaway from 2012 that we have to remember is, yes, Mitt Romney, I think if we had all had to put money before the campaign started on who the nominee was going to be, it was Mitt Romney. And Mitt Romney never really trailed, and then Mitt Romney was the nominee. So there, in retrospect, it seems like it was inevitable. At the same time, there were a lot of scary moments for Mitt Romney, and people like Herman Cain, Newt Gingrich, and Rick Santorum bubbled up and offered him a challenge that was not, you know, at no point was he sort of assured of the Republican nomination until relatively late in the process. And the caliber of candidates that Jeb Bush, playing that Romney role, is now going to face versus what Mitt Romney faced, when you're talking about somebody like Ted Cruz, who's a big, can raise a bunch of money, really popular with the core primary Republican voters. Scott Walker, a successful governor who, again, can really fire up that base and doesn't kind of, I mean, it's certainly kind of coming at it with a more impressive resume than Rick Santorum did at the same time, yeah. Right? Rand Paul, who it certainly seems like he can outpace what his father did in terms of who he can bring into the party. Marco Rubio. I mean, you go down the list. These are very legitimate candidates, all of whom could be a standard bearer for the Republican Party. And so I think that, yes, you know, so far Jeb Bush has to step up. So far, Scott Walker has certainly kind of made hay. But I think that this is going to be an incredibly competitive primary because the quality and caliber of candidates on the Republican side who have shown serious interest. I mean, these are people who are hiring people, who are starting PACs, who are really doing more than just dipping their toe into the race is significantly higher than it was back, you know, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. One thing I also was, I mean, I've never actually asked you this. I wish I had way back when. I guess I inherited when we were both at The Hill, I inherited the Huntsman campaign when it was clear they were not doing as well as they expected to. Do you remember the Romney people ever saying before or after if they were worried about John Huntsman? The White House surely was. But I could never tell when Huntsman jumped in. I just remember near radio silence from the Romney camp.
I think that Huntsman, especially because of his role in the Obama administration, and his place is sort of a centrist and then trying to navigate the Republican primary that way. I think the Romney people were smart enough to know that he didn't pose as much of a challenge as he would in a primary, right? And so in a primary or in a general John Huntsman would have been a very dangerous candidate for Barack Obama because he could have attracted, he would have had the Republican base, and then he could have made a real play for independents and moderates. That's not who votes in primaries for either party, right? You're not going to see, I think, in our modern political climate, a moderate be able to go in and fire people in Iowa and South Carolina. And so the catch, I think, for both parties is finding a candidate who can survive the primary process, but also then pivot and move and draw in the independents. Barack Obama certainly succeeded at that. Mitt Romney certainly struggled with that. But, you know, somebody like Jeb Bush could play to that middle ground. Somebody like Hillary Clinton's polarizing to a lot of people, but she also could motivate, you know, a different coalition than we saw, one driven by women, if she's able to kind of bring up an economic message that fires up the middle class. I think that could be compelling. But I think for both parties, that's the big concern, is how to run a primary that allows your base to have their voice heard, but then produces a candidate that's viable in the general election.
This has got to be like kind of a frustrating week for Hillary. I mean, duh. But also because she spoke at this Emily's List 30th anniversary the other night, and it was like right in the midst of like fallout of not having email gate or something. And, you know, so a lot of that was overshadowed. Plus the speech was lame. But a lot, what she hit in that speech, she gave a shout out to Obama. She gave a shout out to Elizabeth Warren, which I don't think she's ever done before. And then she hit a lot of the populist economic themes of Warren and talked about sort of inequality and the importance of equal work for equal pay for women and men and families and stuff. And like, it was really clear that like they probably had this speech expecting that there was not going to be a big story coming out. And so they were going to like, they expected a lot of the coverage to be like on Hillary's newfound populism and how she hinted on that. And, you know, like this, and they went with it still because they haven't really figured out how to respond effectively to this thing yet. And that was lost, but I'm sure they'll come back to it later.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is going to be really important for Hillary, both in the Democratic primary and to do what we were just talking about, which is that she needs to make a case for why she wants to be president, not simply that she is an inevitable candidate sort of steamrolling towards the White House. She is, you know, by and far, all polling indicates she's more likely to become the nominee than I think anybody in a long time. But we were saying the same kind of thing when Barack Obama appeared, you know,
that's a big question.
8 years ago. And so I think Team Clinton is very cognizant of that. Team Clinton is also very cognizant of the fact that the big political debate right now is about the middle class and inequality and how to address, you know, we've seen economic growth and prosperity at the top, and a lot of Americans don't feel like they've had purchase in this recovery. And so for both parties, selling a message about how to address that, I think, is already the key question of the campaign and the clear sort of defining issue of this presidential election.
Yeah, I haven't seen too much of that. I think we will. I mean, we know that a lot of the GOP candidates know that they have to hit that note, like especially Jeb, who came out early on that, and Romney during his three-week dalliance with kind of sort of possibly running a third time. I don't know.
I mean, to just talk about the White House angle of it, I mean, if you watch that State of the Union address that President Obama gave, I think the White House even conceded that most of those proposals weren't going to be viable in a Republican Congress, right?
Yeah.
he was throwing things out that are never going to pass through a Republican-controlled Congress. But what he did was lay down markers that a Democratic candidate could run on. And so because your relevancy at this point as President Obama is tied to the influence that you can exert on the future of the party and preserving your legacy and building a map for the future of the Democratic Party, it was no surprise to me to see his State of the Union address so aggressively sort of, he termed it middle-class economics, but that sort of issue of inequality, I think everybody is sort of figuring out how they are going to tailor their message to sort of address that in a big way. Now, one thing that I will kind of concede to you is that in recent weeks, we've seen a turn towards foreign policy. I think it's been really interesting to see the Republican Congress. You know, typically, presidents, especially in their second term, focus on foreign policy because it's an area where they can still kind of exert themselves without having to deal with Congress, right? So you're president, you can send troops somewhere, you can go have meetings with leaders in faraway capitals and negotiate treaties, and you don't have to worry about Congress kind of screwing it up because inevitably at this point you've got opposition in Congress. The difference is this time the Republican Congress is not really ceding ground to President Obama on these foreign policy issues. We saw this week with the Netanyahu speech. This was kind of a historic break from the sort of status quo of how Congress and the presidency interacts. And we saw from President Obama some real annoyance over that. You know, he said there was a spray that he had with the new defense secretary, Ash Carter, that I was at earlier this week. He kind of had this weird moment where he was like, here in America, you know, foreign policy is directed through the executive branch and through the president. And that's how things work. It's interesting because, you know, constitutionally, of course, Congress is kind of given the power to declare war. And that's been an interesting evolution and struggle that's borne out over our nation's history. But it was one of those moments where you kind of see a little anger or frustration flash from the president. And I think it's been interesting that Republicans have really found the most traction in this new Congress by the Iran deal, ISIS, these sort of issues, rather than domestic issues, which is normally sort of what an opposition Congress would be focusing on. But they've kind of struggled because they've had to cater to a Tea Party base that can't work well with the moderates in the Republican Party towards an economic or social agenda to make a lot of progress there.
Yeah, one thing, and like, shouldn't it also be, shouldn't foreign policy be, shouldn't foreign policy be an area that hypothetically, like on paper, you would think would help Democrats this cycle, right? So the front runner in the Democratic primary is a former Secretary of State. There are three top potential candidates on the Republican side are governors who are notoriously weak on foreign policy, and because they don't have to deal with it, and try and compensate for that, or try and sort of speed read their way through when they decide to run for president. But Walker had a little bit of a kind of stumble, but like so far, foreign policy might be an area where the GOP field in 2016 maybe is a little bit stronger. I don't know.
Well, I think
except for Rand Paul, right? Everyone says that Rand Paul has a real, real problem with foreign policy because of his libertarian leanings, right?
Well, I think that Rand Paul's sort of realist University of Chicago-esque foreign policy stance.
Yeah, you went to the U of C, Justin. Yeah, where fun comes to die. Why didn't you ever buy me one of those shirts?
I'm sorry.
You're not sorry.
Because you still live there.
Yeah.
Is something that's outside of the mainstream, certainly at the Republican Party and primary voter. But I think the reason the Republicans have gained traction here is that the Obama administration has admitted that they got kind of caught flat-footed with the rise of ISIS. They did not expect this to happen, and to happen that quickly, and to happen so aggressively. And so when you're on your heels and you're playing defense and you're trying to figure out how to sort out, you know, the rise of this crazy deadly terrorist group and a crazy deadly terrorist group that is also very adept at staging these sort of horrific events that capture the attention of the nation, right? We see these gruesome beheadings and burnings and just really horrific, I think, things. It puts you into a tough spot if you're the White House and if you're Democrats to sort of defend your foreign policy as working while there are these graphic images kind of on TV. And so it's provided an opening for Republicans.
It was really effective in 2014, and I've talked to Democrats who grumbled during ISIS, and they were like, we were ahead or we were doing a little bit better than we should have, and then the ISIS beheadings just came in and we got hammered on that point. We got to hit one last point, which is this weekend, President Obama is heading to Selma. And this comes at, while there's another big event going on right now, which is Ferguson and that stuff. So race issues are coming up again for the Obama administration. I gotta be honest, Justin, I don't actually know too much about this, so you gotta explain what's going on here. I was not aware that they're leaving this weekend.
Yeah, so it's the 50th anniversary of the march across the bridge in Selma this weekend. The president will be down there on Saturday for an event commemorating it. And that kind of kicks off, or maybe is the cornerstone of a broader effort by the White House to focus on these issues. We'll see the president go tomorrow to South Carolina. He's going to visit a historically black college down there. He is doing some radio interviews, one of which came out tonight and the other will be out tomorrow morning, where he kind of talks about the legacy of this. But you're right, this all comes on the backdrop of what's been going on in Ferguson. The Department of Justice yesterday released a report detailing some of the systematic racial abuses in Ferguson. They cleared the officer involved, Darren Wilson, and the Michael Brown incident specifically, but they also found sort of systematic abuse of constitutional rights in Ferguson. And for the White House, I think there's both political pressure and internal pressure coming from the president to address this in a meaningful and real way. The extent to which they're able to do that is constricted by Congress, by the way that the U.S. justice system is set up, and state and local governments have like a real control over their law enforcement agencies. But the president convened a task force that came up with a report that was released earlier this week with a wide array of suggestions of things that could be done, including purchase body cameras, the release of new data about race and ethnicity and police stops. So that's going to be a big push that I think the president feels passionately about, even if it's not getting a lot of headlines. The other sort of aspect of all this is, of course, the march from Selma to Montgomery was about the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was a key component of it was gutted in a Supreme Court decision in 2013. Congress can go in and sort of restore part of it if they are so inclined. The way that the law works is that states or districts that have a history of discriminatory practices at the polls would have to clear any voting law changes with the Justice Department before they go into effect. The Supreme Court basically struck that down, allowing states like Texas and North Carolina to create new voter ID laws to change, early voting and how often people or absentee voting, change those kind of practices. Democrats, of course, charge that these are efforts to limit minority participation at the polls because minorities are less likely to be able to take off from work, less likely to have IDs, those sorts of things. Republicans argue that this is a sort of voter security issue, making sure that people who are who they say that they are. But this is another push that I think we're going to hear President Obama kind of really emphasize over the next couple of days.
I feel like the Obama administration sort of, and we all, like, when Obama came in, everyone said this is a post-racial era of U.S. history, which is ridiculous. But I felt like the sense was there would be a lot more focus on the first black president and less race relations. Do you think the Obama administration has sort of learned or had to change how they approach racial controversies, you know, going back from, I guess the first big one was Skip Gates getting arrested to Ferguson? I mean, is there a visible sort of growth or evolution or sort of change about how they deal with sensitive stuff like Ferguson?
Well, April Ryan, who is a White House correspondent for the American Urban Radio Networks, she's actually on the other side of this wall, wrote a book about the president and race that just came out. It's a bestseller. I'm starting to work my way through it, and it's something that she's reported out really well. I think it's called The Presidency in Black and White. I'll plug her book for her.
Okay.
But I heard her talk a little bit about it at Politics and Prose the other night, and she said that the president, especially in his first term, kind of made a conscious effort not to frame issues in a racial context too much, because he didn't want to be defined as a black president, and he didn't want his reelection to be something that was polarized on racial lines. But what she said was that she was, I think, optimistic, and that her reporting indicated that these are issues that the president is more willing to sort of engage with and in. I'm not sure that everybody who has been involved in what's been happening kind of in the protests surrounding Ferguson and Staten Island has been very happy with the president's reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think the White House could make a case and has made a case that the president's sort of measured response to that has both kept things from flaring up more than they have already, and that the president in times of crisis across the board has been somebody who's interested more in results and more in systematically addressing a problem than taking, you know, making a big statement or making a bold proclamation. I think he's been actually burned a couple times when he did that. We saw after
the police acting stupidly, I think, remember, that came to mind.
Sure. On race specifically, or the elementary school shooting up in Connecticut, we saw him kind of take dramatic action, call for big sweeping changes to gun laws, and that fall flat on its face. And so instead, I think the president's preferred approach is to take kind of slow, systematic steps to chip away at things, to figure out ways that you can address the problem step by step. And one metaphor that he's a big fan of using is kind of a baton that you pass along, and you just want to make progress. And I think that really informs his thinking and informs the way that he kind of addresses some of these issues of race.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Well, I think we'll see more of that going forward. I don't know. I don't know how to end this, man. I think we're at a good point to stop. Justin Sink, thank you so much for coming on. I really enjoyed this White House edition. You were lacking without the quips, though. But, like, I don't know. That's all I got. If you got any closing remarks or anything other than that,
I like that you're watching Fox News over there. I didn't know that TPM got Fox News. Yeah,
so that's a signature thing. So we have Fox there. We have CNN right in front of us. And then MSNBC over there and CNBC in the other room. But Fox is behind us. We are actually
Harrison Ford in a plane crash?
Yeah, I just saw that up here. Han Solo's in trouble. It's neither of our beats. But like, I guess that's what I've got.
I'm more interested in Han Solo than anything else.
Well, he's in the new Star Wars movie. It sounds like he's okay, but he's injured. Now CNN just changed it to Harrison Ford crashes plane, condition unclear. Doesn't look good.
Well, this is...
This is a glum way to end the show,
yeah,
isn't
it? Yeah,
I know.
This is kind of depressing.
There's no way to recover all our best to Harrison Ford. Yes,
yeah.
All of our best to Harrison Ford. Justin, thanks. Sink, thank you so much for coming on Woodruff and Strauss. Next week, Betsy will be back. I will talk to you later.
All right, see you. Thanks, man.